Hello and welcome to the NRL Supercoach Champions podcast. I'm Joe Fitz. It's the second week of finals, but for this Bulldogs fan, it's already the deep off-season. And joining me tonight for the formal handover of the wooden spoon from his team to mine, it's Wilf.
How's it going, Joe? It's good to finally be rid of that wooden spoon officially. But yeah, obviously not going very far between us.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got a feeling I might need to find a nice cozy spot in the house for it. I'm not sure that it's necessarily going anywhere next year the way things are going out at Belmore. But if anyone wants to step up, maybe if Madge goes at the Tigers, they can, you know, Tiger's going to Tiger. Maybe they'll fall in a heap as well and they might be a dark horse for the spoon next year.
I hear there is a bit of a space in one of the areas where, you know, there might have been a set of speakers, maybe a soundbar that used to be there. That sounds like a good place to, you know, to display a nice wooden spoon.
Oh, my God. Look, I've said my piece about Lachlan Lewis, you know, for a while now, and I still am yet to see the DNA test that actually proves he's related to Wally Lewis. But, yeah, look, the Bulldogs keep signing terribly mediocre halves, but at least in this case they had a bit of an out and a little bit of salary cap space, but just wish I could trust them to fill it properly.
Well, they've finally gotten rid of him, so I guess that's probably a bonus, I guess you could say, even though I don't know. I don't understand why there's so much controversy about him being terminated. Like, he literally stole from the club. And I get there's some other players out there who've done, you know, relatively much worse things. But it doesn't mean that someone who steals from your club doesn't deserve to get the flick as well.
Yeah, it's. I mean, a lot of the stuff that people seem to be complaining about are things that might be morally dubious behaviour, but they're not illegal. What Lachlan Lewis did was hand in the cookie jar, 100% illegal. You broke the law. You knew you were doing it, mate. Your contract's getting torn up. That's just the way of it. I mean, it's. I think gone are the days when you've got, you know, with Todd Carney playing up in Canberra and, you know, having the bloke in the getaway car in the seat next to him getting sacked, but he doesn't because he's talented. I think there's a bit more transparency and accountability at the NRL level nowadays. And Lachlan Lewis is certainly no young Todd Carney when it comes to talent.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you started talking about Todd Carney and talent, and I'm trying to figure out where you're going with this, Joe. Like, where's the comparison between Todd Carney and Lachlan Lewis here?
Get your mind above your navel, Wilf. What have we got? What have we got in the show tonight?
So, look, we've got a couple of things. You know, the good thing is we don't have to do any of the kind of catching up on how depressing our ranks are and all of that type of stuff. It's good. That's all over. This is the off season. We can have a bit of fun. So first and foremost, though, you know, and you and I, obviously NFL finally kicked off. And so this NFL Fantasy, the Top Sport NFL Fantasy Charity League, officially underway. But week one, not so great for both of you and I. We're both off to big fat L's, aren't we?
Yeah, it did not, didn't go particularly well for me, to be fair. So I've got a pretty decent side, but just kind of came up short against the Whisper, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess the silver lining to this is we've both lost to fellow Supercoach teams, not the dirty, nasty NRL fantasy teams at this stage. So I'm pretty dirty about my loss. I had the fourth highest score in the whole league this week, just happened to come up against the monster score from Lakey. We play this on Sleeper and the platform, you know, does a weekly report and they said Lakey just outperformed expectations as highest score in the league, just... Yeah, really dug the boot in, unfortunately. But, you know, I'm pretty happy with my team still. We're going to go all right, I reckon.
In more ways than one, Lakey punches above his ability, mate. So, yeah, there'll be regression to the mean.
Yeah, certainly seems that way. But, you know, it's going to be a good season. We'll obviously keep you guys posted as we go on that if you want to keep following us. And if you do want to know anything else about NFL fantasy, you know, we're more than happy to explain those things and talk through it. And maybe we might get so bored this offseason we want to just chat more NFL fantasy and introduce you guys into the game itself and why it's so good and why it honestly leaves most other fantasy sports in the dirt. But yeah, look, let's talk Supercoach because that's ultimately why we're here. But before we do that, I do want to, you know, spring a bit of a surprise on you. So...
Greetings. And welcome. Quit playing games with my... I want to play a game. game.
I'm nervous because usually I'm in on this, and the fact that I'm not, yeah, anyway, carry on.
That's all right. Look, I just figured this is a bit of fun. I left it off the run sheet, so you had no idea on it. I've prepped a little bit of fun here, and you know, it's a simple game. True or false? That's all it is. Got a couple of statements here based on the 2021 season. Just things as I've kind of been doing my stats research and looking through the year and just looking at some of the crazy things going on. And I'm going to throw some statements at you and you got to let me know, true or false. And that's all it is.
Right? Far away.
Okay. So we know 2021 was pretty crazy, but would you believe over half of the top 20 Supercoach scores of all time were scored this season?
I think that has to be true.
He hits it, he's got it!
That's absolutely true. It's insane. Of the top 20 scores, 12 of them were scored this year. 12 of the top 20 scores in Supercoach of all time, top 20, 12 of them in 2021. It's literally an outlier season. Like the top four scores were from this year and three of them were from one man alone. It's ridiculous.
PVL ball. I think history will judge the 2021 season as almost being like the steroid era of the NRL, or you know, those couple of years in swimming at the Olympics and Commonwealth Games where everyone was wearing those kind of ankle to neck swimsuits and all those world records were being posted. It's unfortunate that some good footy is going to get lost in all of that, but yeah, I had to go with true on that one.
And it was a pretty good guess. All right, so from the penthouse to the outhouse, 2021 featured three of the top 10 lowest scores of all time. True or false?
Three of the top 10. Well, Chris Sando is not playing, so that is automatically like three. From memory, Mitchell Moses, I remember, has had, you know, some minuses and some zeros. But I think it might actually be true around that kind of 5 week period of the crackdown where there are a lot of sin bins and some sending offs early. So I'm going to say it's true.
No.
So look, I've tricked you up in this one because you're on the right track. You're right. The sin bins, the crackdown, it definitely set us up for some of the lowest scores of all time. So the true statement is actually there were four of the top 10 lowest scores of all time this season.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. That's the game you're playing, Wolf. Okay. Gloves are off. It.
And you know, you're spot on because it is about the send-offs. So in 2021, I mean, we had about, I think, seven send-offs. So not all seven obviously ended up on this list, but I'll give you the scores. So the lowest score of all time is still Trent Hodkinson from 2018, where he scored negative 12 in 29 minutes. That's pretty impressive. But number two of all time, Herman Esa-Esa. I don't even remember him playing this week, this year. And it's probably true because he spent 8 minutes on the field in round 10 and scored negative 11 because he got sent off.
Wow.
That's some effort. Now we've got Daniel Saluka-Fifita playing 5 minutes in round 16, also got sent off, negative 9. Then we got my favorite player, Tyrell Fuimaono.
Oh, yeah.
13 minutes, round 10, negative 8. Yeah. One send off and one HIA KO that just killed my season. Good old Tyrell. And one Bronco on the list, too. Kobe Hetherington in round 14 played 12 minutes and scored negative 5 because he also got sent off. So. Yeah, it's been a good year for, you know, the highs and certainly the lows. This crackdown was not fun.
Again, PVL ball.
That's right. So, look, as you said before, there's definitely been some amazing footy being played that's going to get lost in the midst of this all. But one thing I will say is that Tommy Trbojevic, this season is going to be in the record books for a while, at least from a Supercoach perspective. So my statement on Tommy Turbo. Tom Trbojevic scored more than two-thirds of his points in the 2021 season in attacking stats. So that's tries, try assists, try contributions, line breaks, and line break assists.
I don't know how that could not be true, so I'm going to say true.
He hits it, he's got it!
Tommy Turbo scored 2,149 points this year in like his total score, right?
Unbelievable.
It's ridiculous. Just literally ridiculous. Now, from that, guess how many was his attacking stats?
So that doesn't count. So it doesn't count runs, tackles. Yeah, it's just the base stuff. I'm going to, I don't know, 1,400?
You're pretty good guess. 1,435, which is exactly, rounded off, it's 66.8% of his total points. So you are spot on. More than two-thirds of his points this year were scored from attacking stats.
That's just staggering, isn't it?
Considering, again, he averaged 143.3. It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, unstoppable in the regular season.
Yeah, that's right. Let's not talk about the postseason yet, because I guess this is where you're right. Like, there's a chance this season doesn't get remembered with in the same breadth as Benny Barber 2012 or Jarryd Hayne 2009, where, you know, they took their teams to deep in the finals. And obviously, yeah, that's not quite happening right now for Tommy Turbo, but we'll see. We'll see. There's obviously another game this week, which will determine that. But yeah, 143.3 season average and 95.7 points per game in pure attacking stats. That is just an absolute attacking machine. It's ridiculous.
It's bananas. I will just quickly as an aside, do you think that, I mean, you know, we've talked about other sports, talked about NFL before. I know that in the NBA, you know, there's players that are fantastic in the regular season, but in the playoffs when they're obviously longer series, there's a little bit more time for people to prep and coach against them. Their, you know, efficiency can be, or their talent can be blunted. Do you think week to week in the NRL regular season, coaches just focus on doing what their team does best, but in the final series, there's a bit of a shift in focus to stopping the attacking or the other side? Because I, you know, there is a version of this where Tommy Turbo's not gets found out. He's still a freak and a phenomenal player, but people just looking at how Craig Bellamy is able to kind of blunt him and trying to copy that as best they can.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just because the reality is in NRL, there's only so many good coaches, so many Craig Bellamy's and coaches of that caliber who are able to find ways to contain Tommy Turbo. And I think the reality is they only play a certain number of games per season. So the vast majority of teams aren't able to come up with a plan, or even if they do, they can't execute it well enough to contain him. So I think that might be more of what it is, whereas when they get to the finals, obviously usually that's the good teams, good coaches, or in the Storm's case, the best coach right now. And we saw yet again how they managed to really take him out of a game and just blunt that effectiveness, and in turn, you know, really, like, not to disparage the Seagulls, but they often really are just a one-person team right now.
Yeah. Yeah, just that little bit of momentum in the forwards give Tommy an extra half step of room to play, and then it's away. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting because yeah, that was quite a performance by the Storm, and Turbo just kind of was just lost. So anyway, good to chat and get your opinion on it.
No worries. And look, our final statement for today. So moving from obviously one standout player, really the player of the season, to one of my favorite players, Brian Tor. So if you took out all the tries, try assists and try contributions scored by Bizza, he would still have finished as a top five centre wing for the season on average alone.
I'm going to say that's false because weirdly I think his base dropped a little bit as the year went on, and there were some phenomenal high scorers. People forget Brett Morris's start of the season and your Ruben Garrix and all that kind of stuff. So I am going to say it's false, this one.
No.
Close.
I should have known if you put a Brian Toto, you know, pumped up stat in there that it would have been true. I'm an idiot.
Look, sometimes you got to play the player, not the game.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Your reasoning was sound, and bringing up Brett Morris certainly was worthy of mentioning, but you're looking at it, and so he averaged 84 this season, right? Just behind Ruben Garrick, and is 87.5. So if you look at his average, when you take out his tries, try assists, and try contributions, what he scored was, all right, so if you take out all of the tries, try assists, and try contributions, so from Bizza's season total of 1,512 points, he still scored 1,238 points, or from his 18 games, that's basically an average of 68.8 points per game purely in his, you know, non-major attacking stats. So I've still left his line breaks assists in there, but yeah, it's a impressive number, and that puts him at fifth overall on the season, edging out Dane Gagai, whose season average was 68.4. And we can all agree he had a pretty fantastic season there. So just an incredible beast, Brian Tor. And it's going to be hard not to start with him for next year, honestly. I'm just thinking about it. Like, he hasn't scored that many tries, honestly, and he's still just pumped out such consistent scores all year. I don't know. Where do you sit on that one?
Yeah, I mean, he did. It's funny. I'm you know, we'll talk about, you know, some of the lessons learned and what we might bring into 2022 shortly. But I think, yeah, it's hard. It's that's going to be so much money, but you've got to think that, you know, they do change up the magic number, and, you know, you can't kind of have a $10 million salary cap and having one player being kind of $1.2 million or whatever Tommy Turbo would be based on the current kind of economy of things. So there might be a bit of a compression where the elite become a bit cheaper and maybe the rookies are a little bit more expensive, just to, you know, to make a feasible team of recognizable faces for a lot of kind of non-Supercoach junkies to play the game. So if To'o is kind of a reasonable price relative to some of the other people, he'd certainly be attractive, but oftentimes it gets pretty hard when you've got a handful of base price rookies named in the center wing. And, you know, if To'o is more expensive than four base price rookies that might be starting on the wing or in the, you know, something like that, it's pretty hard bang for buck to not want to go with the cash cows and look to upgrade to To'o in kind of round five or six.
Yeah, I think it's, you're right. We're going to definitely dive into some of the main takeaways from this season that'll help us prepare for 2022 shortly. But yeah, I think he's one of the players that I'm, you know, obviously he's not Tommy Turbo, but and he's also obviously not Nathan Cleary on that tier of player. But outside of those players, I think he's one of the real standouts for just giving you consistent points in a position that's really tough, and obviously still offering that upside. Like, we saw his massive round 25 score as well. So yeah, I definitely, if I had a top five, he's definitely well entrenched in my top five players that I really want to start 2022 with.
You know, the really funny thing is that the premium center wings, your Brett Morris's, your Brian To'o's, actually were really good for, value for money this to start the year, because PVL ball hadn't really kicked in yet. So there was an inflation in their scores that was going to happen just by the nature of the game changing. But we've had a year of these incredible scores now. So your premium price center wings, there's really nowhere to go. And I remember in preseason, Bear, you and I talking about, you know, some of the either one-hit wonders or the, you know, some of the different guns when we were talking about preseason selections. And one of my points was, does everything have to go right for this player just to repeat that success? And I think with a lot of these players, maybe not Brian To'o because he didn't get, you know, that many tries, but there's a lot of premium price players out there that everything worked perfectly. You know, the rules, other players getting injured or suspended that gave them more minutes. And I don't think rugby league's sustainable at the pace that it is with PVL ball. So I do think the scoring will lower a little bit, and that's probably going to impact your premium price players. I don't know if that's a bit too cerebral for the deep off season, but it's kind of where my head's at the moment.
No, I think you're right. And that's where, like, I come back to it. I think that base of his, that floor, is what sets him really apart. Like, you're right, because he honestly didn't score that many tries. You look at his tries scored for the season, he only scored 14 in the regular season, which for a winger, really not that great, honestly. I think, you know, for him, that puts him at 14th across the whole NRL for the year. I mean, Charlie Staines has the same number of tries and he's missed a bunch of games as well. So to me, like, I just think he's not actually at his peak. Like, sure, I mean, maybe he can't sustain this ridiculous work rate every season, but if he gets 90% of it, like, he's still going to be the premium center wing, because unless you're counting Ruben Garrick repeating a history-breaking point-scoring season where he scores 21 tries and also, you know, kicks a ridiculous amount of goals. Like, I can't see Brian Tor not being in that top four or five player, and just the fact that you'll get him in, have those consistent points for round one, and probably save a trade across the season.
I would suggest that Brian To'o's success is more replicable than Ruben Garrick's, frankly. So yes, if it's a choice between those two premiums, To'o all day.
Yeah, and again, if you look down the next couple of names, like Alex Johnston, I mean, Nico Hines won't be there anymore, Dane Gagai, they're all benefiting from lots of tries and plenty of try assists and stuff like that down that left side of the Rabbitohs as well. So, yeah, lots to think about. I just thought there was really, an opportunity to look at some of the crazy stats from this year and crazy, I guess, outcomes based off 2021 NRL and obviously the NRL Supercoach season as well. So, look, you did pretty well, honestly, all things considered. 50% from those four statements, not bad, not bad at all. Especially since I sprung it on you.
Yeah, that's approximately Sam Walker's goal kicking percentage, so I'll take it.
Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and dive straight into the meat of the podcast. Spring is in the air, the birds are singing, and the flowers are blooming. And our friends at Manscaped are here to make sure you don't make a mess of your flower beds when you're grooming, if you know what I mean. Make sure you're keeping things fresh this season with the leaders in male grooming and their brand new 4th generation performance package. Boys, get ready for a spring like no other. Jump into things with Manscaped. Join the 2 million men worldwide using Manscaped by going to manscaped.com and get 20% off and free shipping with the code CHAMPIONS. It is time. It's spring. Summer is only 3 months away. I know people are starting to worry about getting into their bikini bods, getting ready for shredding season, but you can't just look after the outside. You also got to take care of what's underneath those budgie smugglers as well. It's time to get into the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0. And inside this package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer, the Weed Whacker ear and nose hair trimmer, Crop Preserver ball deodorant, Crop Reviver toner, Performance Boxer Briefs, and a travel bag to hold your goodies. The new Performance Package 4.0 includes the new Lawnmower 4.0. This fourth generation trimmer features cutting edge technology everywhere. Got a ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents. Thanks to the advanced skin safe technology, you've got a 4000K LED spotlight that you can turn on and off when you need a more precise shave. Plus, it's all waterproof. It's got the Weed Whacker, which we've raved about plenty of times. And then when you're looking good on the outside, you're looking good underneath. And then you can seal the deal with Manscaped's liquid formulations, the Crop Preserver ball deodorant. There's nothing better than have your balls smelling as fresh as daisies. Then after you've trimmed the bush, you've tended to the flower beds, and then give your balls a boost and use the Crop Reviver. Manscaped even threw in two free gifts to the Performance Package 4.0, the Manscaped boxes and the Shed Travel Bag. Get comfy on the home and on the go this season. Don't delay. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code CHAMPIONS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code CHAMPIONS at manscaped.com. Don't forget to give the balls a spring clean this season. Choose Manscaped. Your balls will thank you. All right, Joe. So this is where we're going to have our next dive into the 2021 season. So we've both prepared maybe our top three takeaways, top three things we learned from 2021. And we really wanted to focus on things that we learned across the season and then that we're going to carry across to help maybe change our actual approach on how we play Supercoach and how we prepare for 2022 and maybe even things like our team selections and things like that. So what's your first major takeaway that you want to bring forward to 2022?
I think really for me, it's obviously around one team, it's kind of critical to get as many hits as you can, because, you know, no one has 25 out of 25 hits, but you want to have kind of 20 solid players that you don't need to immediately replace. But I guess the big learning for me, the pace of the game, the amount of information and good content that's out there for Supercoach means even you need to take risks from the start. So, you know, we talk about, you know, shifting to kind of a pod strategy, whether that's through Origin or certainly for the run home and if you're a head-to-head player as well. But for me, I had not quite chalk. I had probably two or three, you know, semi-pods in my side that I wanted to take a risk on. But I think boldness is what's going to get you at the pointy end. I think even if you have a, rock solid, logical team that generates value. You know, back in the day, that might mean you're kind of firmly in the top 3,000 or 4,000 and well positioned for, you know, to take on overall after a few weeks. But, you know, there were people that were that had perfectly reasonable sides and they're in the 30,000s, you know, after 4 or 5 weeks, and you kind of look down their ownership percentages and there were just no pods, and they had the cookie cutter team, and there's just so many more tens of thousands of highly kind of enfranchised, educated super coaches that get quality information week to week. So the chances of taking it all out, you need to be good and you need to be lucky, as you and Bear well know. I think you've got to risk it early to get your nose, you know, right at the pointy end to start, because it's awfully hard to mow down the people who do take those risks and get the good start.
Yeah, look, I think that's a really, really good takeaway. And I reflect back on my round one team. And like I said, I thought I came out pretty well placed, the best I've come out the first 5 rounds on pretty much any season. And a lot of that was due to having, you know, Brian Tor from round one, not having all of the duds in the center wing, having a few low ownership guys, like, you know, having Mitch Barnett from round one was helpful. And, you know, a lot of switched on super coaches had him as well, but not everyone. So it was a good chance to get ahead of the curve there, starting with Tupanua, Jaden Brayley over, you know, the common popular choices of like Damian Cook and things like that. You know, those choices made a huge difference. And I think that really helped set up my team, you know, to be in a good position, which I've then promptly decided to dismantle for the rest of the season. But, you know, I think, yeah, you're spot on taking that risk. And obviously they've got to be calculated risks, not just, you know, throw a dart at any random center wing. Don't go starting next year with like, you know, this year's equivalent of Cody Ramsey or something like that. Yeah, you've got to have some process behind choosing those risks. But yeah, I think you're spot on.
And often it's getting a piece of those high-powered teams and those high-powered attacks. Again, we went into detail last week where you got a piece of the South's left side with Dane Gagai. Okay, Alex Johnson in the long term was a better choice, but the ownership of Gagai was many, many, many times lower than what AJ was, or obviously Cody Walker and stuff like that. So, you know, they're the ones that if they're getting the tries, you're maximizing your potential to, again, start at the pointy end.
Yep, I think that's spot on. And I guess that's kind of that'll segue nicely to my main takeaway. And look, it's not anything that's rocket science. I think we all know 2021 was the year of the attacking player. So assuming, you know, things stay the same, it's got to be all about those attacking focused players. You look at the top 20 averages, you know, only 3 forwards, and that's Dan Fifita, who was 5th on averages for the season, Isaiah Papali'i in 11th, Angus Crichton in 16th. So, you know, that speaks volumes as to the approach you've got to take. It's definitely not about that base anymore. 4 fullbacks in the top 10. Obviously, Tommy Turbo breaking all sorts of records. Teddy was 4th. Latrell 8th. Pappenhausen, even including his games off the bench, still finished on averages in the top 10. And then you had 3 halfbacks there. Cleary in 2nd overall. DCE in 9th. And Jerome Hughes in 19th. All in the top 20. And we can't also ignore Luke Keary, who was there, obviously, you know, killing it for the first 3 rounds before he went down for the season. And, you know, highlighting again, 3 5-8s in the top 20 as well. Cody Walker in 7th, Adam Dwayhe in 13th, and Cam Munster somehow still in 17th despite what appears to be a disappointing season by most people's accounts. And it's worth pointing out only 1 hooker in the top 20, and that was Harry Grant, who obviously missed plenty of games due to injury. There were 4 centre wings, and that's Ruben Garrick in 2nd, Brian Tor in 6th, Nico Hines in 12th, but obviously he doesn't really quite count because he wasn't really a center wing, and also Alex Johnston in 20th. And outside of Isaiah Papali'i, no front row forwards at all. So Payne Haas was the highest averaging front row forward that wasn't Papali'i. He was all the way back in 27th. So I think that's gonna really, you know, highlight how we might need to structure our teams for next year. You're gonna spend up on those premium attacking minded players, and maybe you just find a bunch of plotters for your front row forward, and maybe you just get Harry Grant and don't worry about hooker, basically.
Yeah. I mean, you know, assuming Harry Grant's kind of injury woes are behind him, that's a particularly viable strategy. And isn't it crazy that that hookers were really the hot tip to be able to take advantage of the rule changes, but that just wasn't the case. You know, so many of them playing 80 minutes, and the speed of the game just meant that they were just trying to shovel on and getting the ball kind of out wide to those attacking weapons. It was a bit of a misplay from a lot of people that wanted to, you know, really double down on the Damien Cooks, etc., to start the year.
It's so interesting because at some level it did kind of, like, you look at 2020, like Cam McInnes, the reason he was so good was because he was in the middle, just making 60 tackles a week and just getting through so much work. Isaiah Yeo was so good last year as well for the same reasons, but then just a quick additional shift in rules and then I guess an off-season for teams to plan ahead and work through those things, and they worked out how to maybe take advantage of the six agains and things like that, which really took away from all that play through the middle. And I think as the season progressed, the hookers became less and less impactful unless you were an attacking genius like Harry Grant or a try-scoring genius like Brandon Smith anytime he was within 5 metres of the try line.
Ridiculous Brandon Smith. Didn't know him all year. Still bitter.
Yeah, look, I'm right there with you, but I think he's way too likable for me to be bitter about not owning him. So
very fair. All right.
What's the second lesson for you, Joe?
Second, look, it comes down to, you know, we've hinted at it a few times, the kind of chaos and uncertainty, you know, throughout the season with the fluctuating interpretations of rules, et cetera, obviously the infamous crackdown. But my second lesson is to prepare to change your evaluation on a player in just a week. Now, you know, don't chase last week's points. Ever since Supercoach has started has been a mantra. I think now we just have to realize that you need to take advantage and jump on a wave, you know, before it starts. And I think, you know, getting on players that ordinary kind of logic would suggest, you know, we talked about Isaiah Papali'i, obviously ad nauseum, but Ruben Garrick's a big one. Even Tevita Pangai Jr., when his role changed at the Broncos, he had a couple of dud games. Everyone jumped off him, but then all of a sudden, you know, he started playing bigger minutes in the middle and his work rate went up. Brandon Smith's a big one, Nico Hines, obviously, but even someone like Corey Harawira and Naira, where, you know, the logic would suggest that Ricky Stewart's so fickle with his forward minutes, and he obviously started in the doghouse to start the year because of off-field indiscretion. So, you know, logic would suggest, no, it'll only be a matter of time until Ricky cycles him out of the team. But by the time he did, about 15 weeks later, because it did eventually happen, all those points, he was such great value for the people that jumped on early. So changing your evaluation on players from week to week almost to take advantage of those windows, they're the get-ons. For me, the get-offs, a lot of people started with James Roberts, and because he was relatively cheap, stuck with him for weeks when people just needed to cut their losses straight away. Tino, the same. Tamalolo was an obvious one for me. I managed to kind of dodge that bullet. But if you did start with him or did jump on, you know, after one game that might have been okay, 1 or 2 weeks later you really need to get off because he was hemorrhaging money and not scoring those premium points. Jerome Luai through the Origin period as well. You've got to be prepared to get off players where the prevailing wisdom in Supercoach year on year and year has always been that you stick with people through that stuff. You don't just hop on and hop off, you know, willy-nilly.
I think you're spot on again. It's just, it's so hard, right? Because we talk about, you know, using the eye test and watching for yourself, and it's so hard sometimes. If you don't feel that confident in your player evaluation, how do you know if it's just one good game from a player or if it's actually, you know, they're in really good form and they're going to be like this for the rest of the season? Like, I think that's the difficulty sometimes in terms of judging whether you need to see another week or whether you should just, you know, act on your gut straight away. So I think that's something I often struggle with, just trying to be conservative with trades and not, you know, be too gung-ho and just jump from player to player. But obviously, yeah, we saw those who were bullish on that and jumping straight away onto players like Isaiah Papali'i really paid dividends for them. So yeah, it's certainly it's a great lesson, I think. It's just, how do you actually put it into practice? I'm not sure just yet.
A perfect example, and I know, again, it does rely on you being able to watch the games, but in Magic Round, you know, we've shared a laugh about the fact that, you know, I captained Cleary for what was then the record, and you captain Pappenhausen, we watched it all happen at Magic Round. But by the eye test, a big reason why Cleary was posted that record score is he was just overcalling Jerome Luai. Cleary was taking all the ball to the left, all the ball to the right, doing all that kind of stuff. And really, that was where Luai fell in a cliff, off a cliff after that. He scored 23 that week. And this was a guy who, you know, was in the mid 600Ks and was one of the best scorers at 5'8". Magic Round happened, 23, then 41, 21, 40, 31, 33, and so on, where he lost $300,000. The eye test, watching Cleary overcall and starving him in that ball, that's the kind of stuff in hindsight, was a massive indicator that Luai wasn't going to have that super coach output.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, in hindsight, as you say, it's much easier to definitively call that, but I think you're right. Sometimes we just got to look for those opportunities and just... yeah, back to gut. If you don't like what you're seeing, then act on it rather than trying to just go, oh, we'll wait another week. Like, I guess you could say, you know, I watched Teddy for that 1 week with Sam Walker at halfback and no Keary, and that was enough for me to go, no, I'm going to pull the trigger. And that paid off for me.
Perfect. And I didn't, right? Because I was, it's Teddy, you know, like he'll kind of steer out of the skid and do all that kind of stuff. But by that time, Turbo had gone up 250K and Teddy had dropped about 300K. You know, it's too late then.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. My next lesson is about trade management. And I say that not because I don't think I know how to manage trades. Like, I've been playing Supercoach long enough. I know the value of a trade, I feel. But I think with the way things shook out at the end of 2021. You know, we were preaching all season, save your trades. It's going to be mass restings. There's going to be all sorts of drama at late season. And for various circumstances, neither you and I could do what we, you know, we couldn't practice what we preached. But, like, it's going to be an increasing trend. It's going to happen more and more. We need depth, basically. And having said that, it doesn't mean just hold mediocre players or hold players that just... they're there, they've got a solid role. And you know, I'm talking about the likes of your Mitch Barnett and guys like that, where, you know, you look at the top 20 overall point scorers and you focus on the guys that played like around the 22 to 24 game mark in particular. You know, some of those absolute winners, you know, Ruben Garrick played 24 games, second overall point scorer there. Isaiah Papali'i played 23 games, 4 points overall. So absolutely, it makes sense there. But then you look at Gutherson in 10th overall, played 23 games. And I think you think about it, right? You could have held a trade, not traded at Gutho, had 23 games played, basically, out of a maximum possible of 24. And you kind of just think, well, maybe not. Like, it would have made sense to have to trade him out at some point, because that 10th overall is misleading because he had some really hot streaks and then he fell off a cliff late in the year, especially when the Eels kind of lost their way for a bit. And then you look at Will Kennedy. He finished 12th overall for the season. Played 24 games, and you just kind of think he really wasn't that useful because he was at fullback and he was, you know, good for a couple of weeks, but he didn't hold a candle to the premium options there. You look at Lucy Leilua, 16th overall, played 24 games, and, you know, he was good for a couple of patches, but on the whole, probably wouldn't have helped you in Supercoach, basically. And like I said, Mitch Barnett, 17th overall, played 23 games. And I think, you know, most of you know how Mitch Barnett finished up. Like, a lot of people just weren't that happy with him, full stop, for most of the second half of the year. So it's where you kind of have to think, like, you're building up depth, but you're not holding players for the sake of holding it. You're not necessarily holding players just for buy coverage. And sometimes maybe you've got to make trades for buys late in the season, but knowing that you're going to be stuck with this player. And they're just going to be purely depth, and you're going to roll them out, you know, in case of emergencies only. I just think those are all things you've got to juggle and manage in terms of your trades across the season. Like, I don't know how the formula is going to look there, but like, these are all things that I'm taking away from this year, where I'm just going to go, all right, I can't just hold a player for the sake of holding them. I've got to do it if, you know, I genuinely think they're going to make a difference and they're going to be valued members of my 17. If not, it's probably worth burning the trade on them earlier, getting someone better that I think is going to go well for the next 10 weeks or so, and then I'll figure out later, basically. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
No, it completely does, because, you know, quite often we'll talk about, even if it's 5 points per game more, extrapolated out over kind of 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, you know, that's a hell of a lot of points, you know, when you're upgrading a player. But the fact of the matter is, you know, regardless again of what happens with PVL ball, resting's not going away. And, you know, I had 12 players for round 25. I think you were about the same, including Sam Walker and his donut that he posted.
Yep.
This is like, you can't rely on having players just because they're available for a week that they're going to suit up, particularly later in the year where a lot of the, you know, the teams like the Storm and Souths kind of have rolling, you know, resting players as they go along. And if you've got the wrong combination of players, you're three or four down on your opponent if you're a head-to-head player, or that's effectively the end of your chances overall if you know, you're at the pointy end trying to win the 50K. So, you know, those 5 point per game decisions aren't worth the trade anymore when they used to be a no-brainer because, you know, the availability was so much more consistent. So, yeah, I completely agree with you, mate. That was something I jotted down as well, that trying to squeeze every drop of juice out of, you know, that cash earning, you know, that pre-buy where it's just a frantic, you know, race to build your bank and build your team value. I think it's less important now that you spend a trade at the absolute peak of someone's kind of maximum valuation just because you're trying to squeeze an extra 15, 20K out over what that price would be next week. I think, you know, long-term we need to be a lot more conservative with our trades at the cost of, you know, what our team value might be in that building phase as well.
Yeah, and I think, like, again, the cost of having two trades potentially for the final round when everyone else is flat out out of the trades, you could have honestly made up 250 points just with those two trades. Like, let's say you had a trade to go from, say, Adam Dwayhe to Anthony Milford for the final round. Milford scored 108, and then maybe you had a spare trade to go from someone who ended up being rested for the final game, and you managed to bring back in Brian Tor for 164. Like, those two trades alone, you know, 272 points, bang. So was it worth burning that one trade a bit earlier where you maybe turned a Luke Thompson back into Payne Haas or something like that, and you might have scored an extra 70 points over 6 weeks? Like, it honestly wouldn't have been worth it when you look at it like that. So I think that's...
I mean, how many people dropped off of Jason Saab early, Bailey Simonson early, and, you know, quite often, I mean, I jumped off Simonson early, and I can't remember the... you know, the cheapie that I brought in instead, but they certainly didn't make that much cash when, if I had held Simonson as long as a lot of people did when he got that fullback spot, he started putting tons together. I mean, that's a massive difference. And the people that did sell him then sold him at a massive profit just because they weren't over eager to move him on for a prospect that probably wasn't that kind of gold plated, you know, can't miss kind of guy.
Yeah, I totally agree there. So, yeah, obviously a lot more to flesh out on this one, I think, but I definitely it's something I'm going to have to be very mindful of for next season for sure. What's the next thing you had written down?
It's the last one I've got, and, I mean, it's a little bit less scientific, but it, you know, it feeds on some of our earlier points. A lot of people, more than I've ever seen, started with a lot of NUFs, a lot of NPRs in round one. And none of them, apart from Sam Walker, worked out. Ben Trbojevic, very popular. Joseph Suaalii, very popular. And you know, even when he got on the field, he didn't really do much at all, frankly. Jock Madden, a lot of people started because he had that halves, you know, dual position. I just think that automatically kind of, you know, we talked before about, you know, no one's going to get 25 out of 25 hits. You're going to have some misses. But if you're starting with NPRs, you're guaranteeing that that slot in your 25 is going to be a miss. And I'm just not sure that it's worth it at this point if they're not in the round one side.
Yeah, look, I think this one hits close to home for me. It was my first year ever starting with NPRs, and I had two of the names you plucked out there in Ben Trbojevic and Joseph Suaalii. So yeah, and let's not forget the one you talked about having worked out at the end with being Sam Walker. It took four or five injuries. You know, a season ended to Luke Keary. Lachlan Lamb got hurt. Drew Hutchinson got hurt. I think Adam Kieran was hurt as well. Like, a lot of injuries basically to the Roosters early on, which gave Sam Walker his shot. And sure, he grabbed it with both hands and ran with it, and well done to him for that. But yeah, he could have really easily, he could have sat there for half the season if Kiri had never gotten hurt, and it would just be in a wasted spot there for you. So,
but I call it a win, I guess, that, you know, people that started with him on the NPR, but the fact of the matter is by the time he was playing his third game and had come into the side, that's the time that you're trying to trade out some of your fattened cash cows anyway. So you have to move those fattened cows on to someone. It might as well be Sam Walker. So it's not that you're really saving a trade anyway, because if it wasn't Sam Walker, you were moving them to, it was someone else.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair way to look at it. So, I mean, for me, obviously, I started with Jamal Fogarty, and that was my downgrade. It was good to free up cash for me and got rid of that guy who just scored a zero due to a hamstring injury. So, yeah, it was a pretty easy move for me on that front.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I definitely think that's something I've got to, you know, reevaluate. I thought it was a good idea so I could get the likes of Cleary into my team for round one. But, yeah, you know, given that we have to be mindful of the trade management side of things, the building up the depth, having someone like that from day dot certainly hurts the team value across the season.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, these are the kind of things that we can kind of break down, I guess, in what will be pre-season in advance of next year when we talk about kind of strategies. But and maybe by then they'll be flagging more real changes or easing off of interpretations, and that'll influence what we do. But I think they're pretty rock solid lessons to kind of drive into our brains, and hopefully we keep them as we look to make our round one teams.
Yeah, definitely. We need to keep that one front and center in terms of planning out round one. And look, my third and final lesson is one that really hits close to home. You know, I'm obviously Ryan Pappenhausen's number one fan and held him all season, probably the only one stupid enough and that was active all season to have held Ryan Pappenhausen from round one to round 25. But yeah, management of injuries, especially, you know, now we know more and more about how the clubs are managing things like concussion. You know, comparing that to, say, a ribs injury for forwards, or maybe an AC joint injury for forwards, and then comparing that to, you know, like a syndesmosis type injury, the thing that Brian Toole came back from that was meant to be a season ender for a regular season, and he came back 2 weeks early. So those things, I think, are really important to take into account and deciding on whether you hold a player or whether you sell them or not. You know, I made some decisions to hold players that backfired spectacularly, so Ryan Pappenhausen front and center there, and I made some decisions to sell Brian Toole, thinking he wouldn't make it back in time because he would have had to go for surgery, but he came back, and you know, I was out of trades to get him back in, and I duly regretted it as he scored about 250 points in the last 2 weeks to really hammer it home that I should have held him. But yeah, I think these are, I'll be very mindful on every time I have an injured player in my team, especially from concussion, how I'm going to treat them. So, yeah, thoughts on that one for you?
Yeah, I think, look, we've gone into the kind of minutiae of why you held Pappenhausen, and I guess that's a lesson learned. But it's not just kind of NRL physio providing an amazing amount of insight that we've never had before into kind of recovery times and risk around injury. There was a fever pitch and a panic kind of vibe around Supercoach this year, which was, you know, that FOMO. If I don't, you know, leverage this 700K that I might have sitting on my bench for 2 weeks, I'm going to be behind. And I think that informed a lot of kind of panic decision making as it applies to trades. Again, we spoke about this with Tim Moody, you know, the week before the final round around Angus Crichton. You know, after round one, he was suspended for a week, and so many people panicked and just went, well, hang on, I can't have a premium player in round two missing 1 week. That was a trade that people made, and then guess what? Everyone traded him back in. Or almost everyone traded him back in for what was effectively 1 week out. So, yeah, it's just keeping your head and being level-headed about this stuff, I think, will just kind of increase the percentages. It won't help you make every kind of correct decision, because again, you'll always have something like a Pappenhausen or something like that that you regret. But you know, if there's 15 decisions like that to make throughout a season, you want to get, you know, kind of 11 or 12 of them right.
Yeah, and look, I will weigh in, because I was one of the ones who got caught up at the start with, you know, the training out of Angus Crichton and things like that. I still think there's some validity to that decision, because we know how important it is to get off to a good start, and Supercoach has always been a front runner's game. So getting out ahead and staying ahead of the pack is much, much easier than trying to chase someone down when they're well ahead of you. So like I said, I certainly understand it, but when you now look in the context of what that trade would have been really much more useful at the back end of the season, it certainly makes sense. And again, this comes back to trade management, which we've discussed as one of the lessons that we're going to take that away for next year. So yeah, look, I definitely agree where you're coming from, but I can certainly still see the validity of some of the decision-making going on at the time.
Well, I mean, not that you can account for injury and stuff, but if not the two most popular trades that people moved Crichton on for in week two were Tamalolo and Ryan Madison, who I think within a week was concussed again. And Tamalolo obviously never even really got started. So there's no guarantee that you're going to use that money to particularly great effect as well.
Yeah, and I guess it comes back to, you know, you just never know with the injury side of things, and especially with head knocks as well. But look, I think we dived into that in a lot of detail, and I think that's, you know, plenty of food for thought for next year, which we've got the rest of the off season to dwell on. So, yeah, look, I think that's a good place for us to maybe wrap up for this week. We'll come back again in the coming weeks with more, as we've said. We've got to keep digging through 2021, and we might actually get some people on to chat about it with us, and some people who did far better than us, I guess you could say.
There's plenty to choose from.
Yeah, I know, right? But yeah, I think that'll be good to kind of dissect some successful seasons this year. But yeah, look, I'm looking forward to another week of NFL. Looks like I get a chance to take revenge for you this week, actually. I'm up against the Whisperer. And would you have it, in a stroke of luck, you get to take on Lake?
I will beat him like a drum. No problems at all. Also, I'm more than happy to circle back on that. He's a good mate of mine. We're in quite a few leagues together, and the banter's always high quality.
Yeah, well, you know, you look at Sleeper gives you some matchup predictions, and you and I are both heavy favorites at the moment, but I think it's going to, yeah. And the thing with NFL is it is very unpredictable, so we'll have to see how it actually all shakes out. But yeah, keyed for it for sure.
Excellent, mate. Well, let's reconvene on that next week. But in the meantime, have a good week, and thanks everyone for listening.
Catch you soon.